Sarah Gorrell through until 2 o'clock this afternoon. I've got a fascinating story for you now, and this is about war artist Eric Revilius. He was a British painter, book illustrator, wood engraver, grew up in Sussex, and did some astonishing art. He was also the first British war artist to die on active service in World War II when an aircraft he was in was lost off Ireland. And bringing his story to life is my lunch break guest, who joins me on the programme. Her book, featuring the war artist Eric Revilius, was published just a few weeks ago. It's called Love As Strong As Death, Revilius, the Pilot in the Missing Aircraft. And delighted to welcome Melanie onto the programme now, Melanie Foreman, who's the author of the book. And thank you so much for joining us. Really lovely to talk to you.
Well, thank you for inviting me on to your brilliant show, Sarah.
It's so nice to have you on, because this is really a fascinating story, isn't it? An incredible life that ended, sadly, very early. But very much he was rooted, born, brought up in Sussex.
Yes, he was brought up in Sussex, especially in Eastbourne. His family originally came from London, and all of his formative years really were spent in Eastbourne. And he obviously, you know, used a lot of the landscape to inspire him, especially in East Sussex. He loved to walk the sort of wildlife paths and get ideas. East Sussex was his kind of like big driver, if you like, as well as what we look at in the book, which no one else has really covered before, his fascination with everything the north. So this is why he ended up asking if he could go to Iceland to look at the light during his time as a war artist.
There must have been a lot of research going on, this lot of work. Where do you begin when you're putting together a book like this one?
Yeah, you know, it's like one of those things where you look at the mountain and you're at the bottom and you're scratching your chin thinking, now should I take the left path? Should I go for the right path? Should I go straight up the middle? What am I going to find? So it can be like a series of kind of really interesting rabbit holes. And I think, well, I can't go too far because then, you know, the book's going to end up like some massive tome. So, yes, there was a lot of research. And I wanted to look at, there are other books, obviously, about Revilius, but mostly about his canon of work. But I wanted to look at his personality. I wanted to look at his life as an artist, what drove him to paint the way he did. And his way of looking at the world, I think, was very, very meaningful. If you look at one of his paintings, it's it kind of drove the old newspaper journalist in me with this question, who, why, what, where, when and how. So you look at anything he painted, and he would love obscure things like teapots and depth charges on the back of the deck of a ship, all sorts of inanimate objects that said something. His paintings were very, very still.
He's left an incredible record of the war, and I'm just looking at some of his work here, which is just, there's something very moving about it, isn't there?
Yeah, I think, as I said, it's stillness, you know, and the questions you ask, what's going on in the painting. And I don't know if you noticed, and I knew he'd written it down, that he didn't like painting faces. If you do look at any of his faces, especially at the lithographs in the submarines, which he was sent to paint inside, very hot and stuffy, and men crowded in all these small spaces, the faces are actually sort of chiseled features. And whilst they all look almost the same, you still get that sort of ominous presence of they're all sort of sitting there in gritted determination in what they're doing. So he was a, you know, a real advocate of looking at, yeah, very ordinary looking objects and making, you sort of know the viewer would make something out of them.
I think what's really, like, I'm looking at some more of his work. So I'm looking at kind of the work prior to the war, or just as the war was looming, and there's just this real innocence about it. You know, there's we've got a couple of women sitting under a tree, just minding their own business. An afternoon tea scene with the beautiful countryside, and then you move on to these sort of quite harsh war pictures, which very much highlights how the world changed in that period of time.
Yeah, it does. And I think, you know, graduating from, I mean, the one you're referring to is called Tea at Furlongs, and you've got this idea where it's sort of on the brink of war, almost. That's the impression I always get from that one. You've got the umbrella, you've got the sun, you've got the countryside in the background, the table's laid for tea, the chairs are empty. You know, so have the people just heard that the war's, you know, Britain has declared war on Germany, and the people have scattered and thought, you know, I've got to be called to action. So after he'd started to sort of paint these very beautiful scenes of, you know, East Sussex and Kent, etc., he wanted to join the war effort, and he became a member of the Royal Observer Corps. So this idea of observing what was going on in the sky, you know, the barrage balloons, all of this started to come kind of like fire his imagination, really. And then, as you said, the war took on a sort of, there was a certain darkness to what he was feeling he should paint. And a lot of these, the items that he was painting were quite weapons of war and aircraft especially. So because of his link to aviation, and he loved to fly in an open cockpit in a Tiger Moth. And can you imagine that, sketching aircraft sort of buzzing around you from the RAF and having to sort of sketch those very quickly? And there's one called A View Through the Propeller, and it's very dramatic, and I love that because it just tells you he was very intrepid, you know, and he'd love to fly, especially open air cockpits. So yeah, if anyone could get down to the Towner at Eastbourne, there's a brilliant exhibition to him there.
And actually, didn't he, was it right that he actually wanted to, rather than be an artist, he wanted to serve in the Second World War?
Yeah, he did originally want to do that, but yeah, somehow he ended up, you know, taking on the role as the Royal Observer Corps, because I think there was a moment when someone from the War Artist Committee had talked to him, probably a member of the staff from Kenneth Clark, who was in charge of the War Committee, of his art committee, of his staff, talked to him about, you know, becoming a war artist, because it was something where he could contribute. So he immediately went in sort of, you know, as a captain, really, which meant that you had another job to do, like a lot of journalists became, you know, were out to report on the war. He was there, and he had a purpose to use his art as well as, you know, sort of record what was going on. And this is what sort of led him to be on that ill-fated flight on September the 2nd, 1942, when he was sent to Iceland.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that and the rest of your book after just a short break. Delighted to welcome onto our lunch break guest slot Melody Foreman, who has written a book all about an artist who has left such an incredible legacy, some beautiful pictures and some very moving pictures of the wartime years. The book, title of her book is Love as Strong as Death, the Revilius, the Pilot and the Missing Aircraft. And this is what's so sad, isn't it, Melody, that life ends very young when that aircraft went missing.
Exactly. It was the whole story, sorry to be a pause there because I'm trying to, you know, assimilate it all. I started the book after someone contacted me, and it was the pilot's daughter. And the pilot's name was Flight Lieutenant Junge Culver, DFM, and he was 25 when he got into that aircraft at RAF Col Dardanis to do a search and rescue mission, because there had been another aircraft takeoff the previous day, just before dawn, and had disappeared. It was his job to take off, find that, see what happened to that aircraft. Now, on board were three other crew members, and Eric Revilius, he'd met in the bar at RAF Col Dardanis the day before, and he said, look, we're going up in the morning early, do you want to come with us? And Revilius said, yes, I really want to paint the light. I want to see what Iceland's like at that time. So, of course, when they took off, it was a, you know, a cold, dark morning, and the aircraft took off, and it was never heard from again. So all of those young men, I mean, two of the crew members were 23 years old. It just vanished. And now I know it happened a lot in Iceland, and it was a big gamble. So one of the parts of the book that I ended up, you know, chasing about and doing lots of research on was you know, the kind of the way the aircraft was, its failings, things that could go wrong with that particular Hudson aircraft. So you were looking at the weather as well, you know, was it ice on the wings? So in a way, it became one of the Second World War's sort of greatest mysteries. So it was all basically, it was the story of those lives that all collided on that one day.
Yes, and leaving a young family behind.
Well, exactly. I mean, the pilot in particular, as well as obviously Rebilius, so the daughter of the pilot, she was 8 weeks old when he was killed, and she never met her father, but her mother, Olive Culver, had kept all of the letters that Ginge Culver, the pilot, had sent to her during his time in the RAF. And obviously they have an amazing social history, because it's letters between two people who love themselves, they loved each other very much. And of course, Carol Lockwood, who's the daughter, who's their daughter, she's now 84. And she asked me if she thought there was a book there in the letters, etc., and the artifacts that come back from, you know, his locker in RAF Coldedanis. And I said, of course there is. I said, there's always a book, and this story is, you know, tremendously kind of romantic, because it's the detail in the letters also that were very interesting. And then, of course, with Rebilius, I was so lucky, because I was able to correspond with his daughter, Anne. So Anne Rebilius is also 84, and I looked at this idea of two daughters growing up without their father, you know, and both ladies have met once at Compton Verney Art Gallery when there was an exhibition, and I thought that, you know, it was a really interesting story. Ginge, the pilot, was the kind of the human who was taking part in a very dangerous job during the war effort, never knowing if he was going to return. He was a pilot with Coastal Command, and it was one of the sort of, they were like the Cinderella service. They were just patrolling, you know, the North Sea, the Atlantic. It was really, really hard work, and they never knew if they were going to come back, you know. And especially out in Iceland, you know, your sort of like lifespan was going to be pretty limited, because the aircraft were quite, you know, sort of unreliable. And then we had Anne's mother, Terza Garwood, also a very well-known artist. She was, you know, sort of left knowing that Eric was very dedicated to his work as a war artist. And the last time she saw him, he said, "Do you not want me to go to Iceland?" Because he was away a lot, you know. And she knew that the art meant probably more to him than anything else. And so Anne Ullman, Anne Rebilius, she was a toddler. She was 18 months old when she said goodbye to her father and never saw him again. So there's all sorts of unifying factors to this story. I couldn't resist. So it became a sort of combination of, yeah, two biographies into one book. Yeah, and so you can imagine the rabbit holes I was sort of going down.
You never know what you're going to find.
So that's why it became Love as Strong as Death. And I found this quote from the Book of Solomon, you know, love as strong as death. And I thought, what was driving them on? And I think it was, you know, the love of not only the life they had with Rebilius, with the art, and with the pilot, you know, his new baby daughter he'd never met, and his wife, and, you know, all of this started to combine that what was driving them on. And then looking at the context of men having to feel they had to prove themselves in the 1920s and the 30s, and all of the kind of, like, you know, Nordic gods and the myths, and why Iceland and its weird enigmatic power, because it attracted lots of artists like William Morris, who wrote a diary about Iceland. And yeah, and it obviously fascinated Rebilius. So that's what I've looked at when we look at his, you know, what drove him to Iceland and the art, you know.
Right, and you, the book is available. How do people get hold of a copy or find out more?
Well, they can order a copy from the publisher, which is Fighting High Publishing, or they can hopefully come to see the In Conversation with me, with the publisher Steve Darlow, at the Towner. Eastbourne on October the 8th. We'd love to see as many people as possible in the cinema. So they've got some in the shop there. Also, Amazon online, yeah, it's pretty available to order from all good bookshops as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the programme. Really fascinating talking to you.